Welcome to Discovery Indie Film. I'm your host, Jeff Howard, and I've got filmmaker Ryan Allen Petty with me. Hey, Ryan.
Hey, how's it going, Jeff?
Hey, so we are on Zoom because it is the era of the pandemic. So Ryan and I are, we can see each other. You can't see us, but we're recording just audio. And if the audio isn't perfect, it's because we're not in the studio together. We're not sitting at a desk with two microphones. This is the audio compressed by the wonderful engine of Zoom, but it actually sounds halfway decent. And I am proud to have Ryan on the podcast. He brought his film American Childhood to the Sherman Oaks Film Festival just a month before last in November 2021. Amazing film, American Childhood. That was a really rewarding block. I mean, I believe there was just four excellent films in your block, and yours batted cleanup.
A little bit of tears.
There were some tears, and everyone really appreciated your work. I just thought it was really. I love a good festival night for sure.
It was a great festival. So cool to like go back to actual theater and see movies again. So many during the pandemic, it's all just been online festivals, which are great. And you get the laurels, but being in there with an audience to see your film is actually really cool. And that's why we all do it.
I honestly had not gone back to a theater until that festival. Like, that festival was my first time seeing movies with other humans. Finally did go see Spider-Man, but and there was only four people in the theater because I went to a matinee.
You even see people in a movie or in a TV show, and you're like, oh my gosh, they're not wearing a mask. They're awfully close to each other. What are they doing? You can't do that. So it's funny, but you guys were really safe about everything too, which is cool.
Yeah. The White Fire, where we hold the Sherman Oaks Film Festival, very serious. The owner's very responsible, and he made sure we followed protocols, and he was checking the vaccine cards himself. And yeah, it was a great festival, actually. And as far as I know, there wasn't a single nobody got sick. Which is nice.
And you did a great job with the Q&A. You don't get a lot of that either. People asking just really good questions and taking your time with every filmmaker. So that was actually really nice and really refreshing the way you guys were able to maintain that.
Thank you. I mean, I'll be honest. I see almost no value in a film festival without Q&As, like nice long Q&As. Like, I don't want to just watch films. I want to hear from the filmmaker.
Yeah. Just hear what they went through, what inspired them to tell the story, and just
celebrate
the journey. It's very cool.
In fact, the long Q&A we do at Sherman Oaks isn't long enough for me, which is why we're now on a podcast with no time limit, so you can really tell me your story. I should mention before we jump into your story and the air quotes interview portion of this is that American Childhood is going to join the next season of the Discovery Indie Film TV series. People should definitely check that out. It's probably going to come out in March, and we're recording this in January. I'm pretty sure it'll come out in March, season 5 of Discover Indie Film. That's on Amazon Prime Video. People just have to go to Prime Video, hopefully on a big TV, not on your phone, but because films should not be watched on phones, no matter how old you are.
High definition TV, at least,
Yes, a nice 4K. I mean, whatever. I don't even have 4K yet, So American Childhood will be in season 5, which is wonderful. And so that's why Ryan's wrapped up his festival run, and we're gonna talk about his film and him. And I guess, I mentioned people should check it out. There are 4 seasons for people to check out already if you go to Prime Video and search for Discover Indie Film. But I'll tell everyone all the rest when we get to the end of this. But right now, go ahead. Tell me, what was your inspiration to get into filmmaking? Where did you start as a kid? Was it a high school, college kind of thing?
Yeah, I mean, when I was a kid, I studied a lot of acting. So I was in a lot of plays and stuff. And then I started doing some of the behind-the-scenes stuff with it and really loved it. And the one big thing that got me, my dad got me into doing these slideshows. So this is before digital. And we'd have to it was actual slide film. And you had these three slide projectors and this dissolve computer where you hit a button and you record onto the left track the audio cue, and then it feed back into the computer so it dissolves. So you program it all beforehand. But he helped me do one for my cousin, and then he let me do the next one. And it was such a cool experience to me, because at that time, I know when every cue is going to happen. It's all pre-recorded. It was up to 2 o'clock in the morning the night before, programming everything. And we would always also go to the wedding that day and take pictures at the wedding and then go home, develop the film and stick it in, which again, doesn't sound like much today with digital, but back then it was very difficult. So you get like that wow factor. But I would sit behind the screen and just watch everyone's reactions and, you know, watch tears come down people's eyes when you put the picture of the grandmother there and you do a little bit of a slower dissolve and hitting the thing with the beat of the music. And that's what really, really hooked me to my guy. From that moment on, like, I'm going to be a storyteller. And then just, you know, when I was, it was time for me to get my first job, my brothers and sisters worked at McDonald's, and I'm like, I'm going to work in a movie theater. I get to watch movies, you know, for a living. And then my first day, my mother, she's like, you are not allowed to go any R-rated movies. And I'm like, Mom, it's my job. I have to. What are you talking about? So, yeah. The first break I had, I went to an R-rated movie. But just being able to watch people's reactions then and see these big summer blockbusters come in and a theater full of people, like, and just the energy that would feed off. I would watch what people reacted to in a good way, in a bad way, what they loved, what they hated. It just kind of like took notes. And then I kind of went to film school a little later in life. I came from Cleveland and I went to the New York Film Academy here on the Universal lot. About in 2007, and that was kind of cool. I got to make some films on the lot and stuff, and I came prepared, which was I think different from other students I went to. It was difficult because they just kind of thought it would be cool to be a filmmaker, but you know, I really, really wanted to, and I came with a notebook full of ideas. So even some of the like little homework projects we did ended up like going to festivals. And I love being able to have a wide range. I would do like some like a torture scene, one film, and like a kid's film the next time, and just kind of always shuffle it up. And that kind of was incorporated into my filmmaking of, I'm going to make you laugh, I'm going to make you cry, I'm going to make you think, I'm going to make you feel, kind of all in one roller coaster ride. And then right when I was about to graduate is when the first that writer's strike happened. So like my producing instructor came in and said, well, get ready for Hollywood to be shut down for the next like 8 weeks. And it was really disheartening, because then just getting the job afterwards was difficult. And then I worked on a lot of like independent projects doing all kinds of things. And that was kind of the hard thing too in LA. You need to do one thing very specifically. Like, what are you? You're either a cinematographer or you're an editor or you're a production designer. But I love doing all of it, which was really hard to get a niche. I would have to find these independent projects where I was able to kind of do everything and have all my talents shine and do the music and do the editing, because I was a storyteller. And then in between making films, I was a dog trainer for celebrities in Los Angeles. So I worked for Will Smith and Kaley Cuoco and you know, Pink's dogs and Johnny Depp's dogs and Simon Cowell's dogs and all these. My day would be a crazy thing, just going to these different celebrities' houses and not just training their dogs, but you have to kind of train them. You know, you have to just instruct them on what to do. But it was kind of a cool way to fill my time in between films.
That's a very cool way. And I guess it's incumbent on me. I know if there were other people, there'd be like, wait a minute, how did you develop this dog training skill? Because that's a pretty high level skill, I think, to be able to go into someone's home and, yeah, both train the dog and teach the owner how to work with their dog and train their dog. Like, where'd you learn that?
I was always really good with dogs, and it was just a friend of mine at the time was doing it. He needed some help, and I kind of resisted for so long. But you know, at first it was it can be very daunting, because I would work with pit bulls a lot. Like Kayla Cuoco had some pit bulls that just had some behavioral issues, so we would have to calm the energy down and stuff. And then it just clicked and became second nature. I was doing it for so long that it's like, now I love solving people's dog problems, and you know, become a little bit of a dog whisperer. And I've worked with Cesar Millan a little bit too. So you just learn all these tips and tricks. And all it really comes down to is energy, calming the energy, and you know, chilling out and showing them how to relax. Because if you don't tell them and show them that they can just be calmed down and don't have to freak out every time they see another dog or hear the doorbell, and just shh. That's what it's really about. So it's really become such a really simple thing. But again, the dog connect perfectly with me, but I got to tell these celebrities too. Listen, you got to be strong. You can't let them do this and do that. And you have to follow through. I always say the more you follow through, the less you have to do. So it was a cool, you know, skill to have. And I got this kind of like in with some celebrities. And then as a director kind of, you know, trained me to not be so intimidated by A-list celebrities. I've worked with a bunch of them already in this aspect. So it kind of let me become a little bit of a better director. You know, not being intimidated by talking to actors and giving them.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to say that right off the bat, that's amazing training for filmmaking. Yeah. Is to work with the directors, with people. I mean, is to work with celebrity, work with professional actors, and really did both demystify it.
Yeah,
and be in the position where you are at a certain level, like responsible and in control for outcomes.
Yeah.
Like that's directing.
Yeah. Yeah. It gave me a little bit of power is the wrong word, but it was so much confidence because sometimes these celebrities don't want to listen to anybody, but they're listening to me on what to do for their dog. They let me take care of, you know, their dog, which is a lot like their children. And like Kaley Cuoco's dogs have been like my own children. They're so amazing. They're great dogs and they're great people. Like the Smiths they're so amazing. And in Kaley Cuoco too, she's so just down to earth, and you get to see just kind of like, they are just regular people when it comes down to it. And then it kind of takes that edge off when you are, I mean, I didn't work with a lot of celebrities directing them, but just that experience has given me kind of just relax and just treat them by more like regular people.
That's a fantastic way. That's way better than bartending.
Oh yeah.
And yeah. The contacts
as much as I can too, but you know, try not to like burn that bridge as much as I can.
For sure. For sure. All right. So, and you mentioned making shorts while you went to New York Film Academy here in LA and doing the festival circuit. At what point did you start, like, you just keep making stuff all along after you finished?
Well, it got difficult because that was your crew. And a lot of my crew just kind of scattered. They weren't a lot of local. A lot of them didn't stay in the business. So getting to know, I mean, that's the one problem with going to something like New York Film Academy as opposed to like USC, is you gain a lot of connections from going to those bigger places. But, you know, you get more bang for your buck with going to New York Film Academy. But finding the crew is one of the hardest parts. So it's been difficult. Right when I got out of film school, there was this producer that kind of believed in me and allowed me to make some other cool films. And we made this zombie film. It was one of the finalists for the George Romero contest to be on the DVD for Day of the Dead. And I made a zombie Santa Claus movie. So it was pretty fun. And just doing all these other kind of little projects and contests and stuff like that, like Project Greenlight, I would submit for a few projects for those, and just all these little contests and stuff. And then I started having all these features in my head, and then I started to have this big regret. Like, what if I die? And these stories are still locked in my head that I've been building for years. So I started just kind of putting some of those on paper, and I needed to get my name out there again. And, you know, I had some gaps cause I'm doing the dog training thing. So I'm like, well, I need to be, you know, be known for filmmaking again. And that's when I got the idea for American Childhood. I love to randomly come up with ideas for my films sometimes. And sometimes you just randomly get an idea when you're driving and you make a note of it and you hope not to forget it. And that's what I did. I wanted to do something that didn't feel political, but also had a message, just because we were in the times of Trump and it was scary times. And I wanted to see what I could do as my part, just to bring everyone together. And this whole Black Lives Matter thing and stuff, I just wanted to like unify all of us and just kind of show, hey, we're all Americans in this. We're all kind of, and I, the way I got the idea is I said, I had this junk drawer and I'm going to pull open this junk drawer and find something to use as a story element to kind of tell the story. And I saw the iPod charger. And I'm like, iPod charger. Why would you need, okay, you want to hook up an old iPad. Okay, why? There's pictures and memories. That's how we store memories. Okay, why? You know, someone's gone. And the story just kind of built from there right at that moment. And it was tricky in the sense of when you tell a story about something that's obviously so volatile and people feel so passionately about, how do you do it without having people walk out of the theater or say this or that or the other thing. And I wanted to have this kind of unified message. So that's why, you know, in the movie, what happens in the movie, the dramatic event, it's kind of like, it's a conundrum. It's this thing that is just, it's not really choosing sides, but it's just telling the story. And also it just telling what these kids must be going through. I mean, we forget about that sometimes, that we're all American families and these kids that have to witness this tragedy and go without a father or a mother or some other, you know, relative, or have to deal with this prejudice all day long. So it was, and I wanted to kind of give a little bit of a reality feel to it also. And that's why it was important for me to find a family that kind of looks like a family. And we're just kind of wore the part. And you remember, I talked before, but I would make them do family things together. And I have all this footage of just them just playing basketball and having cookouts and all this stuff to try and they can kind of get that feel and feel like a natural family. And telling a lot of the story through the iPod too was tricky, but also kind of rewarding and kind of gave it that reality feel and you know, using what this kid remembered of his dad to kind of pay an homage to him and show people, hey, you know, this is who my dad really is. This is how I'm going to remember him. And I'm going to, you know, step up now and do what I have to do to take care of the family.
Yeah, yeah. And you made some really great, I think we talked about this at the Q&A in November, but the decisions were so great. And the storytelling decisions were so great. And the directing decisions were great. But especially when you were talking about, you know, being inspired by Black Lives Matter, but wanting to make something that is more meaningful and about family than about politics. And then that makes it an effective political message, because I do wish that your film, we actually had another film in Sherman Oaks last November that dealt with similar issues. And there was a woman in the audience who was there because her daughter was in another film. And during the film, started mouthing off like furious that she was watching a film that portrayed a Black person as a victim of violence.
Yeah.
I can't believe I have to sit through this. And I almost wish that person had seen your film, because your film has a level, and that film is great too, but your film has a level of balance. Like, it challenges that naysayer, the person who would say something ill of Black Lives Matter. Seeing your film, I mean, no spoilers, I suppose, but but your film is, nothing is bulletproof, but your film is close to bulletproof on that, because by the end of the film, how could the furthest right tiki torch motherfucker, and we are allowed to curse on this, is still not going to be able to be against your message.
Yeah, and that was really important to me. And I would show the script to people that, like, you know, and even in my family, that would have a very, you know, strong view, or just all, like, I want everyone's opinion. Does anything offend you? Does anything throw you out? What affects you the most? And I would try to do all that refining when I did the writing. It was really important to me to just not make race an issue. How do you make a movie about race and not make race an issue? And I tried to even not even to say, person is Black or white or that, except for like the news story, which was kind of like what the outside world perceived. But inside that family, they were just an American family who had to go through this thing. And it took a lot of work to kind of get it to that point. Again, I wanted it to be able to speak to everyone. I'm sure, I don't know if I mean, in the end with the credits, I take it again, a definitive approach and make a little bit of a statement. But again, I'm using the own words of these presidents to make a statement. And it was really important to me to do that. And I was really proud of the way it came off, you know, too. And the actress did such a great job portraying it. The kid, Elohim Nikolov, is still one of the greatest actors I've worked with. He did such a great job in just portraying what we needed to portray and giving it this kind of like the serious message and not alienate anybody and try to speak to as much people as possible.
For sure. For sure. So the idea came to you actually from the junk drawer, which is interesting. How long a process was it? How long did you kick around story ideas once you started picturing the kid and the iPad?
Yeah, a lot of it kind of came quick, and that's why I picked Elo. I call him Elo. He's Elohim. He had the look that was in my head. I mean, for me, I'm sure a lot of storytellers are like this. When these movies just play, these stories just play like a movie screen in your head, and you just try to take down as much detail as possible. So it was probably like 2 to 3 months of writing and pre-production and just refining and refining, getting everyone's opinion. It's only a 15-minute movie, so I'm just trying to constantly refine the message, constantly get people's opinion on it. And then, you know, I didn't really have a lot of money, so I just kind of got my friends to – it's important that I pay everyone, even some of the actors, and just – but I got some friends to do it. I do a really small crew because I do a lot of the things myself, but I need someone to help me shoot it just so I could pay attention to directing. And that's, I think, one of my biggest problems. I'm sure people have to go through this. When you're a storyteller, you want to do everything. You want to be able to write, direct, edit, produce. But like sometimes if you want it to be really, really good, you have to hand off some of these things, which is difficult for me because I see this in my head, but it's so hard for me to explain to someone else what that image is or how to capture it. And even in this film, a problem I run into all the time is my crew doesn't know what I'm doing. Like, wait, what are you doing? What is this? What is it? What does this all mean? And then it not until they see it fully edited where they're all like every time just, oh, I see what you're doing. I get it now. But it's kind of a battle I have to have. And this one is when I really let go of some of the things like I would normally would want to shoot it myself and everything. But I think the directing was really important for me because I needed to kind of nail it. I mean, some of that I shot with the iPad stuff, you know, I was shooting with my iPhone and had Hugo right there with me. So that stuff I shot, but the other really dramatic stuff, you know, it was important for me to have a crew do all the things that I would normally worry about and just people that I really trusted to kind of handle those things so I could concentrate on directing. And this is the movie too, that where I got so much in the zone. I felt so much like myself. Every day of shooting, I was so excited to go. We took about 2-3 days to shoot it. And some things that just didn't fall into line until the last minute. And I knew like these moments of synchronicity that everything was going to fall into line. Like the day before we were supposed to shoot at the church, I didn't have a church. And I called my mother and my sister who were supposed to go to church. I said, you guys got to have some kind of connections. And they called all these churches in Burbank and found me a church. And it was the perfect church I needed to shoot at. And the same thing of coffin. I didn't have a coffin, and it's $600 to rent a coffin. And I'm just thinking, wait a minute, I just need to go to Home Depot and get some foam core board and lay an American flag over it. And it'll look like a coffin. Again, everyone thought I was crazy when I was doing it, but you see it ends up working out. You find all these kind of ways to cheat things. And even just, we didn't have enough people to be at the funeral. So it's just, we had to, you know, incorporate these shots to kind of make it look like, you know, a lot of people and do all these little cheats, which to me is the funnest part of filmmaking. When you, sometimes when things go wrong, I get excited. It's like, okay, I'm going to find a better, cheaper, more efficient, cooler way to do this just based off the fact that I have a problem. And yeah, it was a fun process, and it was really great to, be so much in the zone and feel so much like myself again, and just to tell the story. And I'm trying to incorporate that same kind of passion into my writing now. You know, I'm writing a bunch of features. I wrote a couple of them. So I'm really trying to take advantage of this COVID time and tell some more of these stories and get these stories out of my head, like I've always told myself I have to do.
Yeah. I mean, I just want to mention as you're describing it, for anyone who hasn't seen American Jadhood, and you're describing it in such a way that probably isn't communicating how damn good it looks. Like on the technical side, I mean, you obviously did bring in fantastic crew because from the first shot, it just looks great. The lighting is natural and wonderful. The cinematography is great. Of course, we're already talking about how good the acting is, but I bet, especially if we, you know, did the man on the grabbed a person off the street and had him watch your film and guessed, you know, what do you think the budget per minute is on this versus what you're watching on Netflix? And they might say, I don't know, they're about the same because it really looks that good.
Yeah. Yeah. That's why I try to do a lot of pre-production, a lot of just, I'm work beforehand, even just rehearsals to make sure it looks like a $1 million movie, you know, and just, and you use all these tips and tricks. And again, I'm doing a lot of the editing myself and just all this fine tuning. I mean, it was a crew of three people, I think, including myself. So it's just that's the other thing too. I didn't want the thing I hate on film sets is that's not my department. I don't care. And it infuriates me. And so that's why the crew I use are filmmakers who know how to do everything. They're not afraid to grab a boom pole. They're not afraid to go, pick up lunch or do anything. They're passionate about the movie. And that's hard too. And I've tried to do some of these things for other people's story, and it's hard. It's really hard trying to tell someone else's story the way that they want it, and to do one singular job on someone else's story the way they want it. And it gets to a point where it's like, this is not why I'm doing it. This is not why I'm in it, to tell someone else's story. I have all these stories, and that's, if you know, people coming up to you, oh, you're a filmmaker, I got this great story here, you tell you, and I'm like, I don't know, listen, I have all stories, that's not the problem I have. It's just trying to facilitate and find people and the resources to make this film. And again, I probably spent maybe $5,000 on the whole thing. It was probably way less than that, actually, because just of rental, some locations, and food and props.
Wardrobe. Some equipment, some locations, some... unforeseeables.
Yeah. But for what we got out of it, and it's toured all around the world. It's probably gone to 36 festivals and won about 12 awards. Elo, every time I put him up for a Young Actors Award, he usually wins, and he just does a great job. So it's been very effective, which is very cool.
Actually, that's interesting. We don't have we don't delineate young actors from other actors.
Yeah,
but if we did, obviously, that's fine. Whenever someone mentions another possible award category, I think about it and I'm like, why the hell not?
It's on and on. I'm looking. Okay, social justice. Okay, best indie film. Okay, best phone film. I mean, try to find all the.
I mean, that's coming from me, and it kills me. It is true. At least to me, it's true that every film that gets laurels for being an official selection is a winner. Like we sincerely just show good films. I've never understood the festivals where there's good and bad films playing side by side in a block.
Oh yeah. And you guys did such a good job curating them. And that's why it was so cool. Like I shot the film in Sherman Oaks. I edited the film in Sherman Oaks. I lived in Sherman Oaks when I made it. So being in the Sherman Oaks Festival was such a cool experience. And again, just to be in a festival where every other film was a great film. Every other film that you saw was a great film. It's a highly curated festival. And then just to have people enjoy your work at the same time was really cool.
Yeah. Yeah, but boy, it makes it a bitch when it comes to awards, when everything's good.
I know. You want to give one to everyone.
Makes it hard. Yeah, but I'm so glad to know that you're having a great – you had a great festival run, which is fantastic because you deserve it because it's such a good film. And I really enjoyed hearing you say that you were in your happy place while making it.
Yeah, totally. It was a noticeable difference. And I mean, I was just so happy to come do it. And I felt, I don't know the way to put it, just like in the zone, like, you know that because these decisions that you thought you would never think of start coming to your head. You know, it's like, oh no, what kind of pajamas should this kid be wearing? Is he wearing this? Is he wearing that? What color is the wall behind it? What other little objects I put the camera in? Just these little details that you never would have thought of. All of a sudden you have a definitive answer for all these little details. And there's an actual real answer every time for all these little details. And it's just so cool. And even, you know, the more I write, the more I try to be, you know, descriptive of seeing the movie in my head, and the more I write them, you know, the better it gets. And it's just, any good filmmaker, a lot of them, you know, we don't do this for the money, especially, you know, up front, you know, it's all just passion. And how do you, and I look at all the guys I went to filmmaking school with, and they all pretty much gave up on filmmaking. So it's, you have to be so consistent, and every time you do something, you got to learn how to do it better and do it cheaper, do it more, and do it more, not necessarily cheaper, but do it with more feeling, more passion, and just build that little fire inside you that's burning and just, you know, blow on it so it blows up. And it was funny. It was a definite change I noticed in my mood and approach, and even just I noticed it also with my directing style. Sometimes I see this movie in my head, but just trying to just portray to an actors without giving them a line read of, hey, do it like this, and just tell them what's in their head. What's happening right now? Why is this mood important? And it was so cool that even just, you know, the one where I had to have this actress cry, is just what I'm describing to her is, okay, you have to do this all by yourself now. And it's just you and Colin, and just explaining these things to her off camera that just is you're getting these effects and getting the performance you want. And that was the coolest thing as a director, is to get, I got the performances I wanted to just by being specific, not giving any kind of line read and just telling these characters. And the funny thing is, I write a bio for each character that is longer than the script. And it's just a family history, what you went through, what are your fears, and gave it to each of the actors just to have on their own to understand who their character was. And it really helps, you know, as a writer and a director to do that, just to have create a whole childhood for them either. And just to have it. And then the story just writes itself, because you know, the person's this kind of person, you know what they stand for, you know what they don't stand for, you know what their passions are, you know what their fears are. And it's a great tool for the actors to have, obviously. And it helps you just kind of give them the character in your head. And at the same time, it's a great for writing the story, just knowing who these characters are, the dialogue just kind of writes itself.
It's really funny to me to hear you say that, because I, many, many years ago, I used to not teach screenwriting, but I used to do script analysis stuff and help people with their work. And 9 times out of 10, the first thing I did is I said, all right, you got to sit down and write like a 5-page description of each character and really get to know who they are. Because you read a script and there's no definition at all to the characters. You know, the writer doesn't even know.
Dialogue back and forth, so there's no pizzazz to it. Yeah, that's a great tool.
And then they'd write amazing stuff in the bios, and I'd be like, okay, work that into the script now. Now you have something of interest. Like there's actually something interesting about this person. We can't care about what happens to people if we don't care about the people.
And
I wanted to add that listening to you talk about passion, I mean, I think that's why American Childhood and a lot of the other films that we saw in November, but American Childhood, you had such passion for the subject and for the medium.
Yeah, it's really in me. Like, I know that's what I'm going to be doing for the rest of my life, or you know, hopefully. And it's hard because I'm kind of a jack of all trades when it comes to storytelling and when it comes to other things. I was training celebrities' dogs for years, but it's hard to, how do I leave Will Smith to go, you know, make movies? And it's a tough decision, but the magnetic attraction is so deep. Like, I know in my bones, this is what I want to do. And, you know, how do you support yourself at the same time when you need to tell these stories? And luckily my wife is a physician right now. So now I'm able to be supported and be able to write these stories out. Cause otherwise, if I had to work a 9-to-5 job, I would never be able to get these features out. And it's so rewarding in itself. And especially now with technology, this little thing right here, the iPhone, is the most amazing film storytelling, you know, writing tool. Because I'll build these characters in my head, and then I'll just dictate into the phone a conversation between these two characters, and it puts the words in, and I copy and paste that into the script, and then I go and I finesse it and add some detail. And it takes all the fear of sitting in front of a blank computer and having to come up with the words. Sometimes that can be scary as hell to just like, well, even you have all these notes, you have this story in your head, but what do I type right now? What is the scene? And also to kind of just tell it out of order. Okay, I have the end, I have the beginning, and I need the middle. And I just dictate it into the phone, copy and paste it. And it takes some of the pressure off and allows you to kind of work at the speed of creativity instead of just being locked with writer's block.
Yeah, and it sounds like you use, that's really cool that you're using technology that way, because it allows, besides writer's block, it probably allows some very natural storytelling.
Oh yeah, yeah.
It's less self-conscious.
Yeah, it's great too, because I think any good writer who's writing properly goes a little insane, you know, because you start becoming these characters, you start thinking like them, and you know, they're going through something. So you kind of have to go on that roller coaster with them. And I always thought it was kind of a unique thing at first. And then I watched Aaron Sorkin's masterclass, and he said he broke his nose one time doing dialogue in front of a mirror. And the one character dives after another character, and he dove into the mirror and broke his nose. And once I heard that insanity, I'm like, oh, all right, it's not so much crazy. It's what you're supposed to be doing. You're supposed to go a little bit crazy. And then, yeah, because I kind of came from acting as a kid, I'm on a walk. I'm dictating this as a character, and I'm crying. I have tears coming down my eye just from what these characters are going through. It also, you get such authentic dialogue and such authentic emotion. And, you know, you might have to finesse it later, but so many projects, even ones I've worked on and other, are just plagued with horrible dialogue, and it's just not natural. And it's all exposition, and it's difficult to get out of that unless you're used to it. So developing these characters and actually acting them out, you know, verbally, and then allowing the dictation to catch it, is so freeing to just create realistic dialogue.
Yeah, that's very cool. It's very cool that you're using it for that, and you're giving yourself the chance to be creative. Even if you're driving down the street, you can give yourself script notes.
And that's the thing too. It's like even just telling Siri to take a note, you have to do it right away. I mean, you tell yourself, oh, I'm not going to forget that line of dialogue. I'm going to remember that. But sure enough, you'll never remember it. And the funniest thing that happens now is, I'll be reading a scene I wrote a while ago, and it sounds like someone else wrote it. I'm like, who wrote this? This is not bad, but it's pretty good. And you forget sometimes that you were in that zone, and you kind of, you know, you kind of blocked out to what you're doing, and you read it again. And you're like, oh wow, no, that's not bad. Good job. And it's kind of a cool experience.
Very cool. All right. Well, I'm gonna bring us back to American Childhood, because I know you said you edited it, right?
Yes.
So really positive experience on the set, sounds like. Then when you got into the edit, were you just super happy with what you'd done, or how did the edit go for you?
Yeah. You know, there's always that point in editing when you start to piece it together, and you're like, I have made a horrible, horrible mistake. But you know, deep down inside, it's there. And that's the coolest part, is when you know, something happens where you get enough of it together, and it's enough of your vision where you're like, oh my God, yeah, it's there. I know it's there. And you can, you know, you're whittling away and honing it, and it becomes this moment too, when it keeps growing. It's like, you know, almost like giving birth. And I was pretty happy with all the stuff. There's some stuff I had to reshoot, stuff I had to fix, but it was mainly stuff like that. Cause sometimes I try to just shoot so quickly and move so quickly that, and it's such a small crew that you, sometimes attention to detail is a little more, you know, difficult. But it's amazing how much too you can just fix by messing around and shuffling things around. Sometimes when I have a hard time editing, it's just good to just put it in a bucket and shake it up and dump it on the table and see what you have there, and shuffle it about a little bit, or tell things kind of out of order, or add a little piece. It's amazing how much too a little sound fix can fix story problems. I mean, you have a sound in the background, or just different, you know, L cuts and stuff you make. Or happened with American Childhood. I was so happy with it. And the music at the end was a little more lighter. It was a little lighter at the end, and it was more like hopeful. And it didn't have, it had what I was looking for originally. It's just being this movie that is both extremely emotional, but at the same time hopeful, but it just wasn't hitting as hard with audiences. So I actually changed the music in the end to something a little more serious. And it's such a subtle move, but it changed the tone of the film so much. And I got so much better reaction from it at that point, just by a little tweak like that. It's really, really amazing how music, it's 50% of the feeling of a film. And, you know, even if it's not, you know, copyrighted music or something like that. And that's the one thing I learned from doing slideshows, is the right song at the right moment, the right dissolve, the right when you cut on the beat of the music. And that's the one thing I love about like Scorsese and just where he has these songs in mind when he shoots, let alone when he edits. And it just, it's nailed. That's why it feels like so perfectly in sync. So, and again, I did the same thing with the edits that I did with the script, and just showed it to as many people as I could, get their opinion. If you loved it, what did you want to change about it? What did you love about it? What did you hate about it? What would you do differently about it? Was there any part that offended you? Was there any part, you know, that you just will remember forever? And just getting all these notes from it. And I would try to go to, same thing with the writing, I would go to people that would, I know they're not afraid to tell me the truth. And I would beg them and preface it, please, tell me what you would change. I appreciate the smoke being blown up my ass every now and then, but I don't need it right now. I need to know what is bad, what needs to be changed so I can make it better. I think we know as people, those people that are in our lives that can give you that honest opinion. And yeah, as much as maybe if you need a little boost, give it to someone who's going to tell you that. But at the other time, tell it to someone who you think will hate it. Show it to someone you think will hate it. And then see how it goes. And that's the only way you can make it good and make it, unbreakable in a way.
Those people are really hard to find. The people who understand, I guess if they know you well enough, they know you have the maturity to be able to make the most of negative feedback of what needs to be improved. But so many people aren't actually looking for it. They're just looking for praise. So it's great that you have the mature attitude towards it of like, don't blow smoke up my ass. Don't tell me it's perfect. Tell me the one thing you don't like.
That's huge. If you loved it, tell me what part you may have changed or what part, didn't resonate so much. And just you always need to know your weakest link so you can make it better. And I did. I went through a lot of little changes, little editing things. Again, we did a little bit of music thing or adding a scene or taking away a scene. And, that's hard too, is when you have a scene that you love and it's like, I spent so much money to get in this shot. I love this shot, but ultimately it doesn't work. And you have to cut out a scene that you really, really love because it doesn't work. And you have to be very real with yourself. And it's tough, but that's what separates the men from the boys. And just what the people that really want to do it, the people that don't, being able to edit yourself and say, I love this shot. I love everything about it, but it does not work in the story.
And even if it doesn't, this is tricky grammar, but even if it doesn't not work, if the story works just as well without it as with it, it's now unnecessary. Like you don't hit your audience with things that are redundant or, your film is never hitting exactly the same note. It's the story's evolving the whole way through. You're really building the narrative.
And like you have to tell these facts, but how do you do it not feel like exposition? Or how do you hit these powerful moments and not feel like it's too saccharine or too forced or too, just telling these in a short form, they always say in film school when we made a thesis film, do not tell a drama. To get people to care about your characters and their story in under 15 minutes is next to impossible, and you're going to end up in the bathroom during the screening because you're so embarrassed and don't want to see it. But I took that as a challenge. I'm like, ooh, I'm going to do a drama. And I did, my thesis film was a drama, and this scene was a drama. And I love that challenge to be able to, in a short period of time, get people to care about these characters. And then there's not a lot of like dialogue. It's more just like those family story kind of situations, which had to feel very real, which were written out, but it was a kind of a different kind of element from the iPad videos to the regular part of the film. But it was, I think as filmmakers too, it's important to challenge yourself, to go to the thing that scares the crap out of you the most and shoot the most difficult scene just because, it's fun, first of all, and being able to take on that challenge full time. And it's extra rewarding. I mean, you can go cheap, you can go easy, you go for the quick laugh or the easy kind of emotion, but what's the point? I mean, unless you're not, challenging yourself and being unique and going the extra mile to kind of, do something different, do something, catching and try to like just, I always thought, like, why do they put the boring part in movies? You know, why don't they cut the boring part out? I don't get it. But so you just try to make every part, you know, move the story forward, you know, move the characters forward. And you know, a lot of it comes down to editing too in the script, of just cutting back all the cut up. One of the greatest pieces of advice I heard, even for writing and for editing, is cut until it doesn't make any sense, and then just back off one step. And then you have, you know, you have what you need, and it's hard to do. It's that discipline to be able to cut the scenes that you like, and you know, change things that even if it's something that a change I don't agree with, but everyone I showed it to has said it. Okay, I guess I got to go ahead and make this change, but it ends up being making for a better product.
For sure. Well, it came out great, and obviously the whole thing was done before lockdown, right?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
You managed to. So did you actually edit during lockdown, or did you manage to have it done before that?
Yeah, I actually had it done before that. So it started going around, you know, before lockdown, and it was one that, like, again, I had a version of it, but I didn't really do a lot with it right away. And then it wasn't until lockdown where I made a couple more changes, and I'm like, okay, now let me try to get it out there. And it's, you know, it's expensive to enter all these film festivals. It's expensive. It can, I mean, I've probably spent a couple thousand dollars over the, you know, the past like a few years just to get it into some festivals, and it gets a lot. But you know, there are some tricks. I found out on Film Freeway you can do a campaign for like $20 to have festivals, you know, like yourself. It goes into an email that goes to them, and they say, hey, here are some new films out, and you want to offer them a deal. And all these festivals will give you 50% off, 100% off, 75% off. And it was like, whoa, I didn't know you could do this. And so it was like $25, $30 to do this email campaign. And I saved probably $1,000 in submission fees just by doing that. And then everyone kind of gives you a discount. And it's, you know, it was great. But you have to, you know, that's the hardest part now is just, I made this great film. How do I get it out there? How do I show people? And, you know, for short films, it's extra difficult. That's why it's great what you're doing now to kind of get, because Amazon kind of changed the rules. And I got it in on, you know, Amazon otherwise before they kind of cracked down on a lot of that. And it was on Prime for a little bit. And then they kind of just took it to where, well, you know, people can buy it, but, you know, that's about it.
Yeah, Amazon's given indie filmmakers quite the ride in 2021, where yeah. Everything the year started normal, and then they did the indie purge of no longer accepting documentaries or shorts, and pushing everyone from the included with Prime to you have to charge.
Yeah,
and but now I believe they take shorts again, but. You know, talk about a place where shorts just go to be lost. I mean,
yeah, it's like, how do you know what is a good short or not? And that's why having these programs of shorts is the best thing, because they're hand curated. You know, we've gone through, these are all good films. You're going to enjoy them. Here's a little theme. And otherwise, they get lost. They get to just leave out in the ether. And they might. Yeah.
I mean, if I was looking for shorts to watch for fun that I wanted to see, I wouldn't have any idea how to find. You can't tell a good from a bad short, you know, on Prime or iTunes or anywhere. So yeah, that was the idea behind. I started talking to filmmakers like you because, you know, like I said, the Q&A's 15, 20 minutes is great, but you don't really get to the meat of a film in that time. It's a good Q&A, but
yeah.
So I started this podcast. Yeah. And then I kept hearing all the feature filmmakers were getting their stuff out there, and these amazing shorts were just like, it's on Vimeo. People can see it on my webpage. And I'm like,
yeah,
webpage.
It's such
who's going to your webpage besides your parents?
Yeah, it's so difficult. And I always thought Netflix should have a section called Quick Flicks, and that they would, I always thought it'd be cool to do where, what kind of mood are you in? What kind of mood do you want to be in? And then using those kind of questions as well. Check out this short film. You'll like that. Or check out that short film. And you kind of, once it kind of knows your likes and dislikes of what you like, you would kind of start suggesting short film. But man, nothing like that really exists. But it's a shame because short films are so amazing little stories that just are not going to do well long term. And the story I always heard, and why, you know, they used to show shorts before feature films back in the day, and then they stopped because the people liked the short film better than the feature film. And then, you know, Pixar brought that kind of back, some short films, but it's really a shame, like showing some pre-feature shorts or showing, you know, they always get lost, but they're such amazing stories. And the only way these independent filmmakers who don't have a lot of resources and can't make a feature film can tell these little stories. And it's, so I commend you again for doing the little program, because it's
really weird. Well, and I agree with, and I think shorts are really special, because indie shorts, I mean, shorts talk about they're, first of all, it's a given that it's a labor of love, because no one is making a short film thinking, I'm going to get rich off of this thing.
Yeah, exactly.
So, I mean, and the ideas, they're so pure because they're being made for all the right reasons, you know, like when you go see a feature, you know, it's been run through a corporate board. It's been run through several levels. It's had test audiences. It's gone through all this stuff to really make it nobody's vision. Like it's pretty rare for it to be a vision, an artistic vision. And shorts, almost as a given, are it's the one chance you have to do something exactly the way your heart says it should be.
And sometimes things will just have to be, are meant to be a really short story, not that feature length. And you know, I do give credit to Netflix. From what I understand, when they want you to produce a film, they just let you shoot the film, what your idea was, and they don't give you a lot of notes like a studio kind of would. They just kind of let you do your vision. But you know, that's still kind of lost with some of the, no one's been able to really do. I mean, there was that Quibi, which is a long story in short pieces. So it's not even telling short stories properly. Like there's never been an outlet that has been, like, has given short stories and short films. They're, you know, they're a real deal.
Well, I'm hoping I can change it. You know, I'm not an all powerful being, but I actually, when we're not recording, I'll tell you something kind of fun that happened. Oddly enough, I have a neighbor. I live in the right neighborhood of Sherman Oaks. Down the street is a dude who actually has AVOD technology. Like he does AVOD is advertising video on demand. So instead, so it's free streaming, but there's commercials thrown in.
Yeah.
And
that's the way it should be.
Now I'm telling you while we're recording, but I found out at a street party over Christmas that he does a Spanish language AVOD. So he has all the infrastructure and he's like, so your film festival, you curate. I'm like, yeah, I curate. It might not happen, but you know, it would be amazing to have a free service that people could watch shorts on. Yeah. You know, they just have to sit through a commercial first. That's all.
Yeah. And again, if you approach it where people don't know, and all the actors I'm sure you never heard of, the director you never heard of, the writer you never heard of, but what kind of mood are you in? You want to see a comedy, you need to laugh, do you need to feel, do you need to cry, do you need to think, you know, and just kind of make it curated in that way so that people can, you know, get to know these really great stories. So I'll keep my fingers crossed for you.
For sure. Thank you. Well, you know, it'll help you too.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, so you actually mentioned, normally after we're done talking about the film, I asked what you got working on next, but I think you already mentioned when we started that you have finished a couple feature scripts since writing American Childhood.
Yeah. I've been trying to write like crazy. The one I wrote, Elohim, the kid from American Childhood, I thought he would play great in this part. It's this beautiful, cute little story about Jesus coming back. And Elo is Jesus, and he's helping this guy, you know, kind of get through some problems. And this guy doesn't know he's having hallucinations. It's kind of like, you know, like Oh God with George Burns, and it's adorable, cute little story. It's kind of gotten branded like a faith based film, which is upsetting, just because it isn't really a broader thing. But because I'm talking about Jesus, but you know, they kind of label it like that, but it really isn't. It's just kind of a beautiful little story. And I'm talking to some producers now and trying to get it made. But also at the same time, I wrote this, I'm writing this horror story, which I just finished the first draft the other day. It has to do with this kind of really dark, tattooing mystery and this guy who would kidnap women to tattoo them. And then they become kind of revered and then they start dying and just kind of what these, the whole, you know, game to catch them and what happens. And there's all kinds of twists and stuff. So there, and now I'm writing another one that's like a sci-fi zombie movie right now also. So my range is like all over the place, but I'm just trying to get as many stories out there as possible. And then just, you know, hopefully one of these is going to hit.
For sure. And the range, I love hearing you talk about these very disparate projects because you do have so much passion for it and you have so much passion for the medium that it makes sense that you wouldn't just focus on one genre or one type of film. And honestly, like that horror sounds really fat. That sounds really good. Yeah, because
I don't want to say too much about it just because, you know, but it's one I'm so proud of. It's an idea I've had rattling my head for like 10 years. I've just been building it in my head and building it in my head and finally got it all, you know, pieced together. I need to do another little rewrite to fine tune it up, but it's also so rewarding to be able to give birth to these stories, essentially, just kind of keep fine tuning. You know, I just hope I could find someone in there to, you know, give me the money to make these things or sell them. I always like, I want to find someone who'll take a little advantage of me. You know, use my talents and take your cut and give me my little cut, and then I'll just keep creating stories. And that's the hardest part, I think, with a lot of filmmakers too that we go through, is making the stories only half the battle. You made a great film, great. Who knows about it? Where is it? How can you see it? It's really difficult, and just a lot of your budget should be, you know, set aside for getting people to know about your film. And it's you know, it's the toughest part of the battle, especially for me. Just I don't have a lot of connections, so it's even tougher to get that film out there or get someone to hear it or get in the room with the right kind of person. And you know, I don't want to use all my celebrity contacts in that way, but you know, I want to like, hey, let's leave a script on a desk somewhere or somewhere.
I got to admit, if the Smiths saw American Childhood, they'd have to be amazed.
Yeah. They knew I was making a film. Some of the people at the Smiths have seen it and they've really loved it. They even contributed to some of the catering for the film, which was cool, but they didn't really know too much about it at that point. But yeah, I would hope that they all would. Kaylee actually saw it. Kaylee Cuoco saw it and she loved it. She thought the kid was amazing.
I bet she sat down with some friends like over the next day or two and she was like, would you believe the guy that trains my dog made this amazing movie? Like, because Lord knows, most of the time when someone you know asks you to watch something, it's not going to be good.
Right. It's going to be like, oh God. Well, you know, just take care of my dog. I don't want to. But yeah, I was confident enough in the work. The script for American Childhood, I did leave on the scripts on the Smith counter, and I left it in a very strategic way at a point, and I came back the next day and it was moved into a different spot. Like someone had gone through it. So I was like, maybe. You always have to be careful too with, you don't want to, you know, cross any boundaries or anything like that. But at the same time, you know, I just want to use the position you're in. And, you know, at least even just to get their opinion, let them know what I'm doing and all that. So it was good. But yeah, these other, I feel the challenge coming of, I have these scripts now, you know, are done, and how do I get them out there? And it's a challenge. You know, you try to maybe do some script writing competitions or maybe people you know, or sometimes you can, you know, pay for an evaluation from a producer and sometimes they might be interested, but you know, how do you do that? How do you navigate that? I know how to make movies. I don't know how to sell them. I don't know how to get them out there. I don't know how to get representation. And that's, I think, is a lot of the big fears for filmmakers out there is, you have this great film, now what? Oh, what do you do?
And it's harder than ever.
Yeah.
It really is because at this moment in time, none of the industry professionals really know what the hell's going on.
Yeah.
Because even before COVID, they were like, well, streaming, this, that, the other, theatrical, you know, it used to be
It's different now.
So different and very recently.
TV show now too. It's like a lot of people tell me some of my scripts would make good TV shows, and then like, well, fuck, like great, okay, but you know, I did all this work to make it a feature, and now to rethink it into a TV show, you know, I could, but at the same time too, it's like, unless you have that connection, just waiting, someone gives you the money to write it all and make it, it's just still kind of, you know, still kind of a dream. But how do you stay alive and keep that passion still going when it's so difficult to get it seen and get it made? But, you know, I'm hoping there's someone out there.
For sure. It's really tough. Well, I'm glad to hear that you've got a horror script, because everyone I deal with is always who's on the business side of things. Yeah. When I tell them something's really great, they go, "Is it horror?" So
it's a genre.
It's the one genre that doesn't need name actors. Doesn't need.
Yeah.
You know, it kind of does change the game. So hell, you make a 7-minute short out of it. Scariest, or you know, a key moment of that feature film, if you made a 7-minute short out of it, all of a sudden you got a kick-ass calling card, you know?
Yeah.
I don't know, it breaks my heart. Like, I mean, obviously, you know, from attending the festival, that I love cinema and I love all genres, and it actually, I really,
I love passion. Your passion comes through.
Yeah. And when I present the Discovery Indie Film TV series to other platforms, because Amazon's great, but I wouldn't mind having it elsewhere streaming. And the first question is always like, well, how much horror is in there?
Really?
And I'm like, well, I got a lot of good drama, a lot of good art house, some great comedy.
For the wrong reason.
A little bit of horror, but it's like, you know, but what you want is you want 10 episodes, 10 little horror shorts in a row. I get it. That's what the marketplace is begging for. But I love horror films. It's just, they're not the only game in town.
Yeah. And again, I love movies. So like, it's just, and I love all different genres of movies, and they're all so good. So it's upsetting that people want just one particular genre, and that it's a shame too. We'll get that. And we'll talk about the favorite movies and just some of the genres that have died. Just some really good dramatic films have just kind of died, or like R-rated comedies have just kind of died. So it's sad to see everything kind of move to one particular universe. I'll say to not ruin what I'm going to talk about, but it's sad that cinema has changed. And you know, Scorsese might have been right a little bit,
and also it is painful that. Yeah, I don't know how art house cinema is going to survive post COVID, because
because everything's TV shows. Everything's just, you know, kind of watching the things. So these beautiful movies that are just beautiful, beautiful stories are, you know, don't have the power to kind of get to the top of things, which is sad.
And there used to be an art house theater, you know, a couple per city, major city, and you wouldn't even have heard of the film there, but you'd go and it'd be like something really cool and different and original. And, now even the Lemley Theater, you know, which used to be an art house theater, you know, they're showing the Marvel stuff, you know, because they got to keep the doors open.
Yeah.
And it's like,
it's so sad because that's all my stories. Are these kind of like, they're funny, they're horror, they're this, that, the other thing. And they're just kind of, yeah, unless there's a superhero in it, it may not be as commercially viable as it should be.
For sure. Well, hey, we can wrap it up and then do the next podcast, which will be your four questions. But is there a website or social media, anything you want people to check out to follow you and what you're doing?
I'm a little behind on social media stuff, but Storyteller Industries is my YouTube channel. And I believe I have a Facebook page as well. So, yeah, if you search that, you can see some of my short films and the ones that I'm proud of on there. So, yeah, Storyteller Industries is the channel there.
Cool. And that's a unique enough name, how you type that into YouTube and you get what you're looking for.
Should come up. It might take a little second, but it's there somewhere.
Yeah, no, the joke I've been sharing, a true story I've been sharing, is that there's this beautiful animated film at the festival last November called The Cat. Mm. And it took place in Tehran, and it was just, the whole thing was a work of art. And then the filmmaker said, well, we are putting, she was Persian from Tehran. And she was like, we are putting it on YouTube so you can just go on YouTube and search for the cat. And I'm like,
No.
There's a few cat videos you're going to see first. I'm like, make sure you put the filmmaker's name in your search, because if you go on YouTube and type the cat, you are going to see a few cat videos that are probably really entertaining, but yeah.
Sorry, like I one time I'm like, well, what's going to take me to get 1 million views on YouTube? What are people watching on YouTube? And I go and look at the top 10 YouTube videos. They are cat videos. The most watched videos on YouTube are cat videos. And I'm like, am I going to sell myself short to make a cat video just to kind of get my name out there? But yeah, sometimes it takes a little more digging to.
You know, you could make a beautiful film and somehow incorporate cats. If only a cat was crawling all over Elo when he's under the bed. All right. Well, hey, okay. So Storyteller Industries on YouTube is for what people should check out. Yes. And now I am going to do the closing spiel, as I call it. First thing, I want to ask for 5 stars, if people don't mind. You listen to this podcast, you could always like it or give it 5 stars on whatever service you're listening. It doesn't hurt to be kind and supportive. Subscribe if you want to be really nice. I mentioned the Discover Indie Film TV series that was born out of this podcast. That's on Amazon Prime Video. Hey, people can watch it and go to Amazon.com and give it 5 stars too, you know? I got to ask now, because there's like fewer reviews than there are films, which means like not even every director who's has a film in it has given it 5 stars. I'm like, we should have a lot of 5-star reviews considering we've got like, you know, 100 films in the first 4 seasons.
Yeah.
But I digress. If you want to learn more about this podcast and that TV series, you can learn about it by going to discoverindiefilm.com and on social media. It's @DIFWINS. And as I said, just go to Prime Video and search for Discover Indie Film and you'll find the first 4 seasons. And when season 5 comes out in March, you'll see Ryan's film, American Childhood. And we talked about the Sherman Oaks Film Festival that Ryan's film was at. That happens every November here in Sherman Oaks, wonderful little neighborhood of Los Angeles. And you can learn more about that at ShermanOaksFF.com. And it's @ShermanOaksFF on social media. And Sherman Oaks Film Festival happens to have a sister festival in June called Film Invasion Los Angeles. Yeah, we started 2 festivals at the same time and couldn't to settle which name was right. And now we just moved them to different parts of the calendar. So Film Invasion Los Angeles, you can learn about. Just go to filminvasionla.com. And it's @FilminvasionLA on social media. And I think, I asked for reviews. I think I mentioned everything. And if people are into it, and if you're listening to this, for fun, I started something called THC Cinema.
Really?
And, because I've watched so many films that would be even better with THC. And January 5th, we had the first movie night over at the White Fire. And it was good. And on 420, April 20th, 420. We're going to have the second THC Cinema night. Just come watch amazing films. And, you know, if you arrive, we're in California where cannabis is legal for everyone over 21. If you're over 21, it's legal and you enjoy that and you want to have fun shit to watch on screen.
So much better.
It's, what can I say? I don't know. I don't know why I gave myself the burden of adding one more project to my life, but I just couldn't resist it. THC Cinema seemed too much fun.
No, I said you gotta see what sticks. So throw it all out there and see what sticks.
Right. And when the owner of the White Fire told me, well, 420 is available, I was like, I guess I gotta book it.
So you're actually doing one this April 20th? 420?
Yeah. Yeah. April 20th up in Sherman Oaks. Yeah, I didn't promote the January 5th one very well because I hadn't really done the math on that. But during Christmas and New Year's, no one wanted to hear about what was happening on January 5th. And then, of course, we got hit with Omicron. So it was like kind of weird to ask people to come out to the theater. But people showed up. We showed 12 amazingly good shorts that were even better when you're high. And then we showed a feature that's really good when you're high. So we're going to do the same thing on April 20th.
Yes, I can.
And hey, look it up. It's It's THCCinema.com, and it's at THCCinema on social media. And what can I say?
Dispensaries on Ventura Boulevard for you to fill up before the film.
Right. I just gotta, I gotta find the right dispensary to sponsor us. That'd be sweet. But anyway, I can tell by Ryan's smile that we could discuss this topic further, but I'll let it go. Ryan Allen Petty, thank you so much for doing this interview.
Thanks, Jeff. I appreciate it. It's been fun.
And I thank everyone who listened.